The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
I didn't know anything about how publishing worked. I thought I'd write the book first and then I'll figure that out. So then my agent started shopping it around, and that process takes a long time. It took about 4 months for her to hear back from all seven of the publishers she contacted, and all seven of them turned it down. Sorry.
If you haven't been following along, the ebook explosion has happened. Finally, after being predicted for 10 years and never quite making it, it happened.
The other thing says here, readers generally don't care or even know who publishes what books.
Here at Digipod, our goal is to help you print your dreams. We understand and appreciate all the effort it's taken to get to this point. So, congratulations.
I just felt like if I could get it in front of readers, you know what I like to say is I took my publishing destiny into my own hands, that's when everything took off. That's when everything changed.
So, I am now shifted to more ebook than non-ebook.
There's almost as much discussion these days about the process of publishing as there is about the content of books. Pity the poor author. And what about we reviewers and critics? Which way should we turn? The growth in self-publishing in particular has been massive, with 18 million self-published books bought by UK readers last year, according to new statistics. How to keep up? Well, one change we've made on Guardian Books is to start our own monthly award for self-published books in partnership with the independent publisher Legend Press. We'll be talking to Legend's Tom Chalmers shortly. But first, to illustrate the author's quandary, even when he or she knows the way around the business, we turn to Kate Pullinger. Her latest novel, Landing Gear, grew out of an experimental crowdsourcing project. It's conventionally published in Canada, but it's only being published here in the UK as an e-book. Let's hear her read us into the plot.
Later, much later, after it was too late and Harriet had too much time to dwell on it, she realised that it was all the fault of the planes. Everything that happened, all of it, all of the stuff, was the fault of the planes, or rather, the fault of the volcano. If the volcano hadn't erupted, billowing into the jet stream vast plumes of ash laden with shards of ice, shutting down airspace over the whole of Europe, none of this would have happened. Jack wouldn't have been suspended from school. Michael wouldn't have spent that week in Toronto. Harriet would never have contacted George Saigo. She'd still have her job, and her son would still believe that people are fundamentally decent. In the middle of April, life was normal. By the end of the first week of May, life had changed.
Clearly recognisable in that are two news events, one of which was the eruption of the volcano, Icelandic volcano, in 2010, which halted all airplanes. And the other of which was the survival of someone who fell out of the landing gear of a plane, as reported in this very paper, which you credit.
Yes, yeah, I first came across the story of airplane stowaways in The Guardian in 2001. It turned out to be a young Pakistani who'd stowed away in the landing gear of an airplane and, as is often the case, had not survived the journey and had fallen out of the airplane's landing gear as it came in to land in Heathrow. And so the idea that I had for the novel was what would happen if this stowaway, in fact, survived.
As stowaways have survived since, haven't they? But just not that one.
There was the teenager who stowed away in California and flew to Hawaii and indeed survived that journey. So people do survive.
Harriet is in a, so unusually, one might say, and conveniently for your plot, receptive mood to somebody arriving on the roof of her car in a supermarket car park. She just gets into a taxi with him and takes him home.
Yes. It's hard to know how you would react, isn't it, to someone landing on the roof of your car and sitting up and addressing you. But that is indeed how she reacts. She's not sure whether he's dead or alive. In fact, she's not sure whether or not she's dead or alive. But it seems logical to her to get in a taxi, the car's been destroyed, to get in a taxi and take him home with her.
It's one of several coincidences in this novel, and I wondered the extent to which that's what you're experimenting with. And one very perceptive Canadian reviewer wrote, if Dickens were writing this novel, he would have used some clever coincidence to connect Emily and the Smith family, Emily being another coincidentally related family. But this is the 21st century, and we have a ready-made tool on hand for manufacturing coincidences. It's called Facebook.
Yes, and social media plays a key role in the novel, with the way that it both connects people and bizarrely can keep people apart at the same time. So there's a theme throughout the novel of Harriet trying to stop herself from tracking her teenage son on social media. But there's another story in the book where Harriet and a young woman called Emily are both, in fact, sort of stalking each other without knowing of the other, and the way in which their lives come together, which again is hopefully not what the reader expects.
Let's scroll right back to the genesis of this book. It came out of a collaborative project called Flight Paths. Tell us about this.
Yes, well, for the last sort of dozen years, really, I've had two parallel lives. I've got my life as a kind of literary novelist and short story writer, but I also work in digital media. I work on collaborative projects that are often participatory and almost always multimedia. So Flight Paths was one of several of this kind of project that I've been involved with, where we tell a story using a combination of text always is always present for me in these projects. Text with video, image, sound, music, and sometimes even games. It's a kind of hybrid, emerging form of storytelling that I've been really interested in. So what I did, you know, the story, as I said earlier, the story, it had been sort of sitting, brewing in the back of my mind since I first read the article in 2001. And then later in, I guess around 2007, Chris Joseph and I embarked on a version of the story called Flight Paths, which tells the story of the moment Jakob falls from the landing gear and lands on Harriet's car in five little episodes that are there online. And that was through a collaborative process that was very interesting. For me, it's a great way of working, collaborating, because of the way it contrasts with the solitary process of writing a novel.
So it's a collaboration just between the two of you, or were other people involved?
Initially, we had kind of a couple of phases for it. And the first phase was online through a blog where we talked about the original article and talked about the themes that arose from it. And we had about 100 people involved in that discussion online through the blog. And those 100 people were sending in little stories, little animations, photographs, little videos, all kinds of things that they thought could feed into the sort of research phase of this project. So out of that year-long sort of open discussion, we then went on to create the multimedia stories that you find online now.
And how many of those stories made it into this novel?
They're all there. But they've been tweaked. Characters have shifted slightly. Not their names, but for instance, in Flight Paths Online, Harriet has three children. By the time she gets to the novel, she only has one. So other sort of little changes like that as I went through the process of thinking about the difference between writing a novel and writing a work of online digital media.
So to what extent is this a single-authored novel?
To what extent is anything a single-authored novel, I think, is the answer. I mean, it is, absolutely. I wrote every single word in it. However, it's absolutely part of a larger conversation. And luckily for me, that conversation has continued because my Canadian publisher, Doubleday, created an API based on the first 30 pages of the novel, which they then went on to create an interactive map based on, where it pins text from the novel to the locations in the world where the characters are at the time that the text is relevant to.
What is an API?
It's basically just the bit of code that allows two computer programs to talk to each other. So, for instance, if you It's the thing that allows pins to go into Google Maps, locations to be placed on Google Maps, for instance. That's a type of API.
Among the people you credit are not only your collaborators on Flight Path, but I spotted the name of your son. And there is one of the central characters, a gorgeous character, is her 16-year-old, Harriet's 16-year-old son, who's sort of 6'5" tall. And there's an awful lot about the way that teenagers live.
He is not Jack, the character in the novel, but he allowed me to pick his brain. He answered my questions about the kinds of words that he and his friends were using at that time to describe certain things, the kinds of things that they were doing. And then also there's the whole business of observing your child. I'm still really fascinated to see how both he and his sister, his younger sister, use the internet. How they communicate digitally is so different from the way I communicate.
So, for example, you have this lovely passage, which I recognise, although I wouldn't necessarily understand what was going on if I were to see it. He had YouTube open so that he could play music videos, Facebook with at least 3, maybe as many as 15 chat windows open so he could chat with his friends in private. Instant messaging as well, so that all of his friends who were also online could join in the conversation, which mostly consisted of attempts to mimic the sound of their own farts through elaborate use of random fonts and keyboard symbols. It makes me feel sort of sick, the thought of it.
And that's 2010, so already already they've completely moved on with the way that they communicate online. And I just think it's really very fascinating.
This is going to date very quickly, isn't it? Because you've sort of like taken a photograph of a moment, technological moment, which, as you say, we're now 4 years on from.
Yes, hopefully the novel won't date in that the story won't date, hopefully. But yes, I mean, that was partly why I wanted to date the section so precisely. I mean, obviously the volcano erupted in 2010. That's a date I wanted to use in the novel. And I wanted to tie the sort of technological themes in the novel to specific dates as well in order to help with that, really.
Underneath this big technological story is a human interest story about a family, which becomes, during the course of the novel, due to these strange coincidences, a completely different sort of family. It starts off as the 2.2 20th century model and ends up having acquired a Pakistani stowaway and somebody who turns up through Facebook.
That is a theme that I've written about quite a lot, really, over the years in many different shapes and forms. I think that for me, there's something sort of fundamentally difficult about the nuclear family. And I think the ways in which people adapt and adopt other people into their nuclear families is very interesting. And there's a way in which the novel is sort of about the loneliness of the nuclear family, the way that it can be quite an isolating unit. And certainly at the beginning of the novel, the family, which is a very small family, Harriet, her husband Michael, and their son Jack, they're really living quite separate lives in a lot of ways. And the novel is about them trying to find new ways to interact. And the way that they do that is through these new relationships with other people.
You give a bit of a false lead in that first section that you read at the beginning, because you said, you implied that the impression of people as fundamentally good or decent was going to be overthrown during the course of the novel. But it isn't really.
No, it's not. No. No, and that is actually something that quite a lot of the discussion about the book in Canada has picked up on. It's something that people have seemed to have really liked about the novel, is that it is about people who are fundamentally decent, and it is about people who are trying to do their best in the world, no matter how sort of badly wrong that goes temporarily.
This book is not available in book form in the UK. You've made the decision to publish it as an e-book. Why is that?
I mean, it's a puzzle to me as to why it's not been bought by a publisher in the UK, particularly since The Mistress of Nothing, my last book, earned out. That book is 5 years old. I still get royalties from it. However, when that became clear that that was going to be the situation, that it would be foolish to not make the book available digitally here in the UK whilst it was coming out with Doubleday in Canada and Simon & Schuster in the US, because of the way in which, as readers, we're so accustomed now, we read a review online, we don't really notice where it's come from, whether it's come from the US, Canada, or the UK. If we know the writer or if the book sounds interesting, we want the book. So it seemed to me like a good idea to go ahead and publish the book here in the UK as an ebook.
Does that mean that a publisher definitely wouldn't pick it up here now because it's available?
No, not at all. And in a way that it depends what happens with the book in the US and Canada.
Is this something you've done before, or was this just a decision?
No, this is a new thing for me. It coincided with my decision to put into ebook some of my backlist, but it's been tremendously complicated publishing electronic editions. The idea that it's simple is really just not true. For one thing, there's a couple of different formats. You have to make sure that readers can get the books in the formats they want. So there's a Kindle format, there's EPUB formats, etc. Then the whole business of making the books available across all e-retailers is also very complicated and time-consuming and not straightforward at all in the way that you might imagine it is. I think certainly I and probably lots of people just sort of thought you just click that button and then it happens. But in fact, that isn't how it works at all. And I've worked with a consultant from the Literary Platform on the whole program. I would not have been able to have done it myself. A, I wouldn't have had the time. B, I would just not have had the patience. It is a complex undertaking.
So how much does it cost you to get these books online?
It also varies from book to book. You could spend very little money or you could spend a ton of money, just depending on what you wanted to do. I didn't have any costs around editorial or anything like that. And I think as a sort of minimum, so you had to convert the book to digital, you had to get a new cover for it, and then the whole process of publishing it. I would think a sort of minimum, if you were going to try to factor in your own time, would be £500 per book.
Do you think this is a route that a lot more writers are going to have to take?
I do. I think there's a real crisis in the midlist. My agent was saying to me that the London Book Fair this year showed a real trend toward, you know, the established huge sellers and then books by new writers. But these days it seems that books by new writers are often by new writers who come with a ready-made audience. So it's the new novel from the person with the cookery show, or it's a new novel from, you know, somebody who's a broadcaster of some kind. So I think it's harder for emerging writers, but it's also harder for people who like me here in the UK are, you know, well-established, have been around for a while. In Canada, I'm kind of the opposite because I won a big prize in Canada with my last novel. So there, I'm a sort of big writer. So it's a kind of schizophrenic existence, but I think that is common to lots of writers these days, in that if you're interested in trying to take a bit of control of your publishing career, then what I've been trying to do with my backlist, I think we'll see more and more of.
Kate Pullinger there, and Landing Gear is available as an ebook in most formats. So now to our new award for self-publishing. And with me is Tom Chalmers, who's the founder of Legend Press and indeed co-founder of this award with us. We've got quite a few issues, Tom, to pick up from Kate there, but let's just start with this award, which is now in its just, we've just published our second winner, which is to say it is a competition to be reviewed. And this has been a little bit of a point of contention with some of the people who've read the reviews, that the reviews are not necessarily entirely singing the praises of the books, are they? What we're saying is we're taking them seriously.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important part of the prize, in the whole idea is not so much in self-publishing, you know, the bestseller charts are dominated often by, particularly digitally, by self-published books. It is sometimes that those who shout loudest, you know, actually are very good self-publicists, get to the top. What we're looking for is the needle in the haystack, more those books, those bits of quality of people who might not be able to push themselves forward, people taking risks. And I think then if we did all that and tried to find them and then gave them some sort of trumped up thing, you know, the whole idea of giving a review is that it creates a level playing field, you know. For a long time, self-published sector have rightly said that the traditional market's kind of closed off to them. Traditional media doesn't want to know. Well, the idea of this prize is actually, well, that, you know, there you go. Here's the space, and let's, you know, we have no control over what the viewer said, and that's kind of how it should be. You know, as far as that was the initial aim of the competition.
Let's have a look at the first two winners then. The first one had a brilliant title, didn't it? It's Dinosaurs and Prime Numbers by Tom Moran, who is a comedian,
which kind of came through in his work as well. It's full of humorous moments. You know, I think he's got a bright future ahead of him.
And Alison Flood, who reviewed it, said it was too full of jokes for her. And she did admit that she wasn't a great expert on comic novels.
It partly comes down to taste. You know, there's some books which are jam full of jokes that work well. The reason we chose that book was also it kind of offered something different as well. It wasn't just a kind of generic book copying a style or trying to do it, you know, a particular style to hit the bestseller charts. It's something that had a unique approach, and that's, you know, that's what we kind of look for. You know, I think we can go further as a competition, but we want to kind of find people who are looking to do their own thing, not looking to do what other people are doing.
And it certainly did drive a lot of our readers through. We had something like 74 comments. Quite a few of the commenters had gone and found the book and had their own comments, and a lot of them were very positive about it.
No, definitely, and I think there were lots of valid comments. I mean, some people saying they want to know more about the process of the competition, which we can do in terms of how it works for our panel of readers, and then how it works. We have a panel of professional judges. I mean, the truth is, we're just looking for the best book. A lot of people are suggesting, you know, kind of different things we're looking for. We're looking for something that we feel deserves attention that might otherwise have got missed. And, you know, with Tom's book, I think that's, you know, we've certainly found one there.
And then the second book is very different, which illustrates your point about looking for the best book. And this is a historical novel, The Right of the Subjects, by Jude Starling. It's about suffragettes.
You know, it was interesting in the review to pick up on how it would have potentially changed if it was traditionally published. You know, I quite like kind of rough things, or maybe I talk too much, as in it should be cut down a lot. But, you know, I think partly that's the point of the competition as well, is that how would that have been changed if it had been traditionally published? Would it have not be as good a book as it is now? Would it have been better? Would it have made no difference? I think for her, you know, it's very powerful subject matter. It's something she clearly cares passionately about. That's a good starting point. You know, sometimes I'm dubious when you hear people kind of say, you know, you should be self-publishing and pumping out 7, 8, 9 books, trying different genres, trying this. And I kind of think actually getting stuck into something that really means a lot to you is kind of more important.
And she can certainly tell a story, can't she?
She does editing work herself, so you can see how she can kind of construct her and put
stuff
together.
But that makes an interesting point, doesn't it? About, so our reviewer said it would have benefited from an edit from a traditional publisher. You can be a really good editor of other people's work, and yet you might still need an outside eye on your own work.
For our writers generally, we always encourage people to go away and come back to it, take as much feedback as possible, because the most important person in the whole process is the reader. And I always think you've made it when a reader takes a completely different analysis of your book than you intended. You know, they go on their own journey with it, and to a certain degree, you can't artificially create that journey of the reader. That's just going to happen. And in this case, you know, the reviewer's taken their journey and given their view on it.
Just tell us a little bit about the submission process. We had for the first month about 500 or something.
Yeah, and it seems to be at the same level currently. We have a panel of readers, each of which selects their top 5 books. That then produces the shortlist, which then goes to the panel of judges, who then read it, who then meet and squabble it out between them, and then select the winner. It will be interesting to do a bit more, maybe, to highlight some of the other shortlisted ones at some point, so there's a point of comparison between the winner and others, is some we're looking at. But yeah, a huge amount of reading.
And also, we haven't yet opened it up to other territories apart from the UK.
Yeah, I was in New York recently for Book Expo America and the main trade fair there, and I was deluged with authors asking me, because I was spoke at an author event and lots, which is good, because I know Washington Post and many people covered it, coming up to me and saying, can you open it up? You know, we're kind of desperate to enter. So that was great to hear. There's various loopholes for these things, as always, from up high, but that's, yeah, it's something we're definitely looking into.
Watch this space.
Yes.
So going on to Kate's points, more general points, she is an award-winning author. She's earned out on her previous novels. She hasn't managed to find a UK publisher, but she said it's not that easy to get published in ebook form either, even if you're willing to go it alone.
Sometimes I kind of think that ebook conversion is a relatively big business in itself, and there can be a case sometimes of people justifying their role. I wonder in the future if people can actually do it themselves. Most good conversion houses I know do cover the main formats and the key ones you need. You know, I think there is a slight grabbing ground sometimes. So, you know, a lot of, you know, Amazon being a key example, but a lot of the retailers want you selling through them and them exclusively, so kind of through formats and through distribution agreements, they try and tie you down to that. You know, there's a current slight air of suspicion that, you know, Amazon are prioritizing, you know, books that are sold through them, published through them, and sold through them, and printed through them with their print on demand, and hence separate conversations with terms and with publishers. And they currently incentivize authors a lot through various promotions when being exclusive you can do. So I think to have your book maybe available on all formats through all retailers, that can maybe be quite challenging. And, you know, I've worked in publishing a long time and still getting my head around exactly what different ones offer. So I think if you're an author coming in completely cold, I think that potentially is quite a challenge. To be able to find neutral advice that doesn't end in, we'll do this for you and it'll cost you this, it can be quite a challenge.
This novel that of Kate's was already published, so it had already gone through a sort of rigorous professional legacy, should we say, legacy. Even then, she said it cost her £500 of her own money up front to get it into ebook.
In a way, you are becoming the publisher. And actually, when I started Legend Press, it was just me, an internet cafe, and I had to then find the money to print our first books and to, you know, and to do the design and to do all this. And I think traditional publishing, the publisher's making the financial investment, and self-publishing, the author's making the financial investment, which creates, you know, which creates a different risk, and, you know, and also creates different rates of reward. If you were going to do it properly, and I think there's a danger of people saying, well, I can just upload it here in Word format to this site and it's going to be available. If you're not investing in proper editing and in proper whatever it may be, and almost acting a bit like a sole trading business, then I think that's a danger. You know, likewise, there's also the scare stories of, you know, people paying £30,000 for some film package and these type of things. So I think, yeah, there needs to be more knowledge out there and kind of clear choices. But I think if you are self-publishing, then you're going to have to invest, you know, you're going to have to invest both time and finances, you know, likely to make it a success.
My name is Scroobius Pip and this is called 5 Minutes.
Now, this is a man for whom self-publishing seems as natural as being born. He's a performance poet who has emerged from the music world, who writes his poetry in the same way as he samples and mixes music tracks and sounds on the dance floor. Publishing for Scroobius Pip is more in the world of CDs, DVD and YouTube than in text or ebook. So let's hear some more from the man.
Each night she lays shivering, quivering there, asking why she keeps forgiving him and living in fear. At work she has a glistening, driven career, while at home with one swing of the fist it disappears. Each night she lays shivering, quivering here, asking why she keeps forgiving him and living in fear. At work she has a glistening, driven career, while at home with one swing of the fist it disappears. She'd often think of different ways to get from under his noose grip. It's one thing to see a path, but it's another to choose it. It's one thing to want to run, but it's another to do it. And it's one thing to buy a gun, but it's another to use it. But buy a gun she did, and it made her feel good. She told herself if she really had to use it, she would. But the next night, at the end of her bed, he stood. She said she'd take it no more, and she prayed he understood. But he didn't take too kindly to being put in his place. She fled after the first blow, and of course he gave chase. She sat hunched, holding a gun, praying she wasn't pursued. And as the door swung, a ruby-red fountain ensued. She watched in awe as his power cascaded on the floor. It wasn't long before police came bursting through the door. In store for her a new prison, this one enforced by the law, as she let out a whisper with the strength of a roar. For the bad times I'll cherish every beautiful second as the bullet enters your head. But for the good times I'll wish you 5 minutes in heaven before the devil knows you're dead. For the bad times I'll cherish every beautiful moment as that bullet enters your head. But for the good times I'll wish you 5 minutes in heaven before the devil knows you're dead. Each night she lay shivering, quivering here. I wonder how we came to live in unforgiving despair. I found myself given to delivering stairs as the smell of Glenfiddich starts sieving the air. Each night she lay shivering, quivering there. I wonder how we came to live in unforgiving despair. I find myself given to delivering stairs as the smell of Glenfiddich starts sieving the air. As the bullet flew towards me, I swear time stood still. I felt every single emotion that a man could feel. How did I get here? How can this even be real? And how did I become the kind of person a loved one could kill? It wasn't always this way. I once saw love in those eyes that now just despise and chastise all my lies. Each new drunken guise, my sarcastic replies, and worst of all, these heavy hands that surmised our demise. There was a time we thought the honeymoon wouldn't end. She was my lover, my partner, my confidant and my friend, but it seems these days happiness can depend on financial stability and the need to contend, but I make no excuses. I let it get this way. Other people live their lives on a minimal wage. I'm the one that buckled and let it turn to rage. Now I'm the one looking down the barrel playing guess the gauge. So for the bad times, I cannot be acquitted or let off as the bullet enters my head. But for the good times, I wish for 5 minutes in heaven before the devil knows I'm dead. For the bad times, I should not be acquitted or let off as the bullet enters my head, but for the good times, I wish for 5 minutes in heaven, before the devil knows I'm dead.
Scroobius, that is pretty dark. A lot of your stuff is pretty dark.
Yeah, it tends to be. It's an area I find myself more interested in when writing, and I think that's largely because in life in general, and quite rightfully so, in the happy times, we try and spend as much time there as possible and relish in it, and in the darker times, we try and get away from that as quickly as possible, back to happiness, and we don't really explore it or get to fully take in our surroundings. So I find it the more fascinating area when writing to kind of delve into and look at these often darker emotions.
Do you think of yourself as a poet? You work as a DJ and you do a lot of performance, but it's poetry for big festivals. You're not to be found hanging out in small poetry venues in London, are you?
No, I mean, I definitely came up from the spoken word scene and from doing open mics all over London. It kind of varies. I'm lucky enough to focus at times on the spoken word and the poetry area, and other times focus on the music, and other times on the radio, and other times on the club night, and so on and so forth. So I took my name from an Edward Lear poem. The kind of point of that poem, just very briefly, is a creature that wakes up in the jungle and doesn't know what it is, and it goes with the fish for a bit and realises it isn't a fish. It goes with the lions for a bit and realises it isn't a lion. And in the end, it realises it can just be a Scroobius Pip. And that's kind of why I took that, because I knew there were so many areas I was interested in and excited in and didn't want to have to categorise myself.
I went back to that poem, yeah. It's the Edward Lear poem, and that chorus, chippity flip, flippity chip, my only name is the Scroobius Pip.
Yeah.
It is sort of rap, isn't it?
Yeah,
Victorian
it really is.
Rap.
Yeah, and it's kind of disregarding any labels put upon you and just saying, look, I am who I am.
I'm really interested in the journey that's brought you here. You're an Essex boy.
Yes, I am indeed.
With a big beard.
An Essex boy with a big beard doing poetry.
White.
Stereotypical, I know. A white Essex boy doing poetry.
Doing rap. With a stammer as well.
Yes, it's crazy because it was only recently I realised that everything I do, the spoken word, the rapping, the radio show, it's all talking. So it's all stuff that if I'd spoken to my careers advisor at school, probably would have politely pushed me in another direction rather than saying, yeah, try that and stumble through it. But I've learned to be quite comfortable about my stutter, and I very much see it as an accent as much as anything, if you know what I mean. So there's a lot of kind of interesting things in it. I think, weirdly, and again, this is only looking back, that my stutter has actually prepared me well for this kind of career, and it's broadened my vocabulary and all sorts, because, I mean, as a kid, I'd be thinking a few lines ahead in each sentence and aware that there's a word coming up I'm going to stutter on, and I'll be trying to replace that word or restructure to have another word in there. So at school and growing up, I wasn't particularly well read, yet I seemed to develop a wide vocabulary. It kind of alludes to how much we don't understand the brain and why that poem, it makes sense to not stutter in that and stutter sometimes when just talking here. There's a comedian's name that I always stutter on, Dylan Moran, and I can never say his name for some reason. It's a weird thing, but a guy taught me a thing of tapping on like a tapping on your arm or on a table, and if I do that I can comfortably say Dylan Moran, Dylan Moran, Dylan Moran, Dylan Moran all day long. I'm tapping my fingers on my arm.
Now that is so interesting, because that relates to the rhythm in poetry, doesn't it?
Exactly, and that's why I think it's a great explanation of why the rapping and all sorts of stuff. I mean, on my radio show, I do stutter every now and then, probably more at the start. The more I'm relaxed, I guess I don't as much. In rapping and in things like that, I don't stutter at all. And in the live show, there's only one or two poems that I occasionally stutter in, and they tend to be the ones that are less rhythmic, the ones that are more spaced out and not kind of driven and performing to a beat. They tend to be the ones that a stutter will sneak in on.
Before you made your break, you worked in a record shop,
yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah, it allowed me, you know, I started there into probably rock, punk and a bit of hip-hop, and I came out with a huge knowledge of hip-hop, a love of jazz, a love of just all sorts of different genres, a reggae and everything else, because of working with people who were passionate about other music and could say, here's, I think you'll like this.
You say the music we've made.
Oh, yeah.
Who's we?
Again, the majority of my career, I've worked with a guy called Dan Lesac, or again, even on my solo stuff, I always work with other people, so I never really see it as a solo.
The poem you read just then was about domestic abuse. You've also written about self-abuse. Yeah. Why such dark subjects?
I don't really write true stories, but most things I write will be drawing either from personal experience of those close to me, or, I mean, the one time I wrote about heroin addiction, I interviewed people about it, you know, friends or people I know that have been through that, because it was a subject that seemed to fit, and I had some things I wanted to say about it, but I didn't know enough about it, so I educated myself on it so I could hopefully give good and honest voice. I've experienced them in people close to me or in relationships and things like that. But I always feel it'd be rude to just tell someone else's story, particularly when it's such a dark and serious thing, and then say, here it is on my CD for £8. You know, it's kind of, that feels horrible. Whereas if I'm creating new stories but drawing from true experiences and emotions, it feels like it's creating a new thing and hopefully bringing up a discussion on a subject that often, yeah, isn't discussed in popular culture.
You've done Glastonbury Latitude, you did Edinburgh last year, yes. And in fact, you've just produced your CD of that.
Yes, I'm putting out a live DVD of that.
DVD?
Yeah, a DVD.
There's a sort of disconnect, isn't there, between this sort of great festival, you know, music celebration, people letting their hair down, and here you come in and show the dark side. Do you think that's because of the aesthetic of hip-hop and rap?
You know, my prime focus when people have paid to see it is always that they go away feeling they've had a good time. I'm not one of those performers who's like, it's my art, like they can take it or leave it. If they're there to see me, then that's amazing. So I love the fact that we can put on a set that's up-tempo and energetic and have a lot of feel-good songs in there, but then also drop in these kind of serious and darker topics. And the hope is that people will go away, first of all, excited and pleased and buzzed at the night, and second of all, as the night's starting to wear down, thinking about and hopefully discussing a few of the topics, and kind of that seems to work.
And have you been published in book form?
I was asked for ages to do a book of poetry, and I kept turning it down just because, for me, my ingestion of poetry has always been live and as spoken word. I've never read much poetry. It was spoken word that made me realise I loved poetry, because seeing it performed by the performer and things like that already got me. So I felt it would be arrogant that just because I had a following to put out a book of poetry when saying, I mean, I've not read many, but you should read mine. So instead I spent a couple of years through the fan base of getting different artists that are fans to illustrate a poem each, so that I ended up having a graphic novel of poetry. And again, the idea was to show people who like me, who would shy away from poetry in general as a kid, that it can be accessible and it can be more interesting. So yeah, in 2010 I released a book called Poetry and Emotion, and yeah, it was amazing to see the talent of the fan base and the kind of a crowdsourced thing all come together and make this book that I'm amazingly proud of.
I noticed when you were reading, you were practicing, that sometimes you changed phrases as you were doing it.
Yeah.
So they're not fixed in the way that a written text would.
Yeah, no, completely. I think everything I write evolves and evolves and evolves and evolves. Whenever I've had a song come on somewhere that came out a few years ago, it's fascinating to hear how much it's changed over the years of touring. And I really think, for me personally, before I got into the recording albums business, I felt that an album was the finished product. You work up and then you record it and that's it. And I've realised that for me personally, it's not. It's very much a midpoint, that the album comes out and then you tour it and the songs develop and tighten and breathe and change in their own way. So yeah, it's always evolving, hopefully.
The inimitable Scroobius Pip. You can catch him next at the Latitude Festival. His DVD, The Astounding Ernest Brace, will be available on his website from the beginning of August. Our next stop is to celebrate Mandela Day with the help of his widow, Grasa Machel, and several authors who've written books about the great man since his death last year. Thanks, meanwhile, to Kate Pullinger, Tom Chalmers and Scroobius Pip. I'm Claire Armistead and my producer is Tim Mabey. From both of us, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. With summer here, you've finally got the time to relax, listen to all those Guardian podcasts you might have missed. And while you're listening, you'll also have time to build that website you've always wanted for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or your blog. With Squarespace, it's easier than you think, and getting started takes only seconds. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code GUARDIAN to get 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.